Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the pod. Gonna get to Bucks Pacers here. That'll be first. Then we're going to talk a little Blazers Lakers. And then we got some news to get to, some more stuff coming down about a potential solution that the NBA would be involved in for young players, both in high school and then during what would normally have been their one and done year, and a bunch of other news around the league catch up to as well. And we'll also give you a little sneak preview of our Patreon mailbag for this month, which we're doing, give you an idea of what you get as a subscriber. So let's get started with this Pacers Bucks game. It was a 92-89 Pacer win, and I think we can start right away with just some of the fireworks at the end of the game, Danny.
Yeah, I mean, this was a game like many right now, and we're still more than a month away from the end season, with massive significance for both teams. And you don't often see a game like that have a jump ball that is actually decisive with 6 seconds to go. And there was a lot of just weirdness before that. So, I mean, you don't want to really start with that, but I think it just gives people a sense, if they didn't watch this game because it was on League Pass, of where this kind of game was. And I think what was weird for me down the stretch was, up until the final minute and a half, I kept thinking the Pacers were going to go ahead by 8 and just salt it away. I thought they were playing better over that last 6-7 minutes, but they just had a couple of missed shots, and then they had a couple of weird turnovers. Actually, the worst turnover was once the game was already close again, and so they couldn't get over the hump until they ended up winning anyway.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable, and we could set the scene with that jump ball at the end. We'll talk a little bit more about the end of the game as well, but I thought this jump ball was interesting. Had some thoughts on it. The Pacers, after Giannis missed a very tough fadeaway on the right baseline, there's about a 6 second differential. The Pacers try to go the Bucks defense, which was awesome down the end of the game with Giannis at center, with the length that they showed finally taking their centers out of the game, gets a steal, and Chris Middleton breaks on the ball fantastically. Looks like he's going to go in because they're only down one for the layup. Bogdan Bogdanovic gets back, and the combination of he and Joseph is able to strip Chris Middleton, but we had a much better idea of what happened than the referees did on that play.
Yeah, it goes back to a couple of different ideas. One of them that I've had is having a fourth official that's basically just watching the TV feed, because ruling it a jump ball, I understand why they do that as a device, because then it doesn't create a presumption either way for whose ball it is.
For the replay.
I get that idea, but it does allow them an out to make a decision, and choosing a jump ball versus choosing it out on either side is a big distinction. I mean, either way, just in terms of the randomness of it, and it was basically a loose ball in those circumstances. And one of the other weird mistakes they made on it was who was on the jump ball was incorrect. I mean, Bogdanovic is the one who made the strip. Corey Joseph never touched the ball. So I don't understand why they said, oh, you, Corey Joseph, you who never touched the ball but was just nearby, the jump ball is with you, though it worked out well for the Pacers because Bogdanovic, the guy who should have been doing the jump ball, was available for the rebound. And even though Middleton got the tip, he basically tipped it to where Bogdanovic was, and Bogdanovic took the ball and then made the free throws.
Yeah, before we get to that jump ball, I'm going to have some advice for NBA players and jump ball. I'm full of advice on these, intentional missed free throw situations. By the way, we posted the video of our call of those intentional missed free throws, or unintentionally made free throw in one of the cases, by Kyrie in that Rockets game, which was pretty funny. I posted that on Twitter at Nate Duncan NBA. Thanks to Ben Dull for doing that. It's kind of amusing. If you want to check that out, get an idea, if you're not a Twitter NBA show watcher yet, what you're missing, about a 40-second clip. But this is why a fourth official is needed. There was just absolutely no way that Billy Kennedy and any of the other refs could get in position. They were all 20 to 25 feet behind the play because Middleton broke on the ball so quickly. There's no way refs are going to be able to keep up with NBA players. And to make the call, to see whether there was a foul, to see whether there was a strip, I mean, Middleton's body was between all the referees and the ball, so they just had no idea to be able to see anything. And you have to have a referee who at least was even with the play to be able to see whether a foul occurred or not, and there's just no physical way for a referee to get in a position. And so there are a lot of these transition plays where it's embarrassing to just have a referee who cannot be in position to make a call and just has to do a jump ball. And then even the replay review, the camera angle was not conclusive enough to make a call, because it looked like there was the strip, and then Middleton attempted to swipe back up and grab the ball after it had been stripped from him, And there was just no way to tell on the replay whether in fact he made contact or not. The spin of the ball didn't change at all. And because the camera was coming from the baseline angle, they didn't have the depth of field to see whether Middleton actually made contact or not. You would have had to have something from the side, and that angle apparently did not exist. So the jump ball was the right call, but it's something that I think the league needs to come up with a solution for.
I'm surprised we didn't talk about the turnover itself. I thought it was a pretty awful pass in the situation for Oladipo, and it was slow enough where it wasn't going to, even if it caught them a little bit off guard, Middleton had the time to react to it and get to the ball before it got to, I think that was Corey Joseph that he was intending to pass it to. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, it was a nightmare game for Oladipo, finishing 5 of 19 from the field, 14 points, and 10 turnovers in this game for him. 10 of the Pacers, 14 turnovers, which is astounding. Now, generally, I'm not as harsh on players when they have a lot of turnovers, but the team doesn't have very many, because that means a lot of times that they're creating so much that, you know, they're making those turnovers with a large number of opportunities, and they're also just forced into making the higher risk plays, you know, when the clock is late or whatever. But no, they really caused problems for him, especially once they went with Giannis at center. I believe Oladipo had two turnovers. One, they just sprung a trap on him with Giannis on a pick and roll out near half court, and he had nothing to do there. And then...
Yeah, forced to travel.
Right, yeah. And then that turnover at the end, which is, I mean, that's the one thing that you just absolutely cannot do. And you really need to just run the time down and get a shot, or just make sure you throw a safe pass, because giving up what could have been a pick six, it was outstanding hustle from Joseph and Bogdanovich to get back into the play on Middleton to save the game for him. And then on the jump ball, there's a few things here. Number one, if you're on a jump ball, and Corey Joseph and Boyan did an amazing job of this, just foul like crazy if it's a critical jump ball late in the game, because if both teams are in the bonus, there's no way the referees are going to want to call a foul that then is going to be free throws, a loose ball foul. So you can really just get away with murder, and that's what happened. Joseph pulled Middleton's arm down. He still got the tip, but didn't get as much onto the tip as he wanted to. And then Bogdanovich, first of all, you see this a lot where the way the geometry just has to work on a jump ball, there's always going to be a space where each player can tip it, where you have two of your own guys standing next to each other. But if you're one of those guys, you need to carve that space out before it goes up, like, and not let yourself just get kind of squeezed together. And that's what happened with Bledsoe and Bogdanovich even before the tip even occurred. You know, they weren't all at 90 degree angles. There was really only about, you know, maybe like a 7 degree angle for Middleton to tip the ball into. And then as soon as it went up, Bogdanovich, knowing exactly where the ball was going to go, just shoved Eric Bledsoe, who wasn't strong enough to deal with him, which is surprising. Bledsoe is a pretty strong guy, but he also was going to actually try and get the ball. And Bogdanovich did a great job just forcing his way in front. And then they had no choice but to foul him. He made two free throws, and then the Bucks had a three to get at the end. But I mean, really, that's what I have to say about jump balls. It's just, you know, it's not something that NBA teams practice a lot of. I think about this stupid shit all the time. So, but it's maybe one thing that as a coaching staff, you could just spend 5 minutes on in training camp and just hope your players at least remember it well enough that if there's a timeout, you can mention it to them.
One other thing I thought of during this game and just went back and verified it was, this is the second time this year that the Pacers had a just catastrophic turnover when they were ahead late. This time it worked out for them because they got back on Middleton. The other one, I remember because I was sitting in Staples Center watching it, was when they were playing the Celtics and they had the ball up one and they were trying to run out the clock, and the Celtics got that steal. I think it was Terry Rozier, and he dunked it before time expired, and that was a game that they should have won. They were ahead by one with like 6 seconds to go and they lost it, and those games can matter. But this is a big three-game sequence that just happened for the Pacers. So they beat Milwaukee in Milwaukee. I think it was Friday last week. Then on Sunday, yesterday, they beat the Wizards, and then they got the back-to-back and got the Bucks. And so they, in that span of about 4 days, really solidified their playoff position. In terms of making it in, also you have the Pistons getting worked by Cleveland and all these other things, and also, you know, getting more solidified, because even though it's not as dramatic as the Western Conference, you don't want to be a bottom seed in the East either.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there's seems to be a big difference with the top three in the East right now. And for the Pacers, this was a big win. They're now projected to be 2 games ahead of the Bucks when it's all said and done. They lead them by 3 games right now in the standings. And so you imagine it's going to be be difficult for the Bucks to catch the Pacers. And while we might get Bucks Celtics or Bucks Raptors, I mean, this is a Bucks team that had designs, and they could still get back into it. You know, it's not like the Wizards or Pacers or even the Sixers who have an easy schedule, but you know, they don't have those wins banked yet. You know, they're pretty close to tied with the Bucks right now. So anybody getting hot or failing to meet expectations could change a ton in that 3-8 range in the East. And with the Pistons lost tonight, they're really totally out of it. 4% chance of making the playoffs. They're projected to finish 6 games behind the Heat and the Hornets, 15% chance, 5 games behind the Heat. So it really is, unless something absolutely drastic happens, going to be an 8-team race here, and it's just a battle for seeding in the Eastern Conference. And especially, you know, we could get to the point now where the Hornets and Pistons begin to start trying to tank a little bit themselves, get below the Lakers. It's hard to imagine that they'll be any different than or any better than the teams in the West playoff race right now who aren't going to make it. Those two teams will be ahead of them because they're going to be trying until the end. Anything you want to see?
Yeah, I want to make one small point, and then I want to talk a little bit about the game itself. But you know, my biggest nerdery thing in the NBA is pick protection, and we are on the precipice of a really fascinating one with this, because the structure of the Bucks Suns obligation is that Phoenix gets the pick if it is 11 through 16. Oftentimes you see lottery protection or something like that, but 16, what that means is if the Bucks finish with one of the two worst records of a team that actually makes the playoffs, they still lose the pick. Right now, the projections are that they would finish with one of the two worst records. Depending on how optimistic you are about A, this draft class, and B, how good the Bucks will be next year, that could be a good or a bad thing. But it is significant for Phoenix in terms of their cap sheet, in terms of how they're thinking about their team. And it's not binding yet, so it's just, it's something to watch. It will not remotely affect the way that the Bucks manage this. Though, incidentally, you could see it if they wanted to avoid Cleveland, where they tanked into it, like they maybe lost the game at the end of the season to keep to get the better spot and they lose the pick.
Yeah, that's
it's entirely possible.
That could happen. That could be a thing.
It could be. And so you have that, but there's a lot of substance that we should talk about with this game. And I think the place to start, you've mentioned it a couple times, but it requires talking about a little bit more, was the Bucks going at the end of this game. I thought they broadly got outplayed starters versus starters, which is surprising considering Oladipo's struggles in this game. But once they put Giannis in at center, they started defending and just preventing Indiana from getting good shots. Even if in isolation, that Middleton defensive play on Thaddeus Young, where if they had gotten a bucket there, they would have gone up 3. That was huge. But just doing a nice job there and forcing turnovers, those are the two hallmarks of a good defense.
Yeah, and it was in marked contrast to the meat of the game in which the Bucks centers really got worked defensively. The Bucks offense, though, continues to concern. This has not been a fantastic Pacers defense. This game was an absolute rock fight. Both teams are on a point per possession, which you don't see as much of anymore throughout most of it. And especially, both teams really killed each other in transition. The Pacers off of Bucks turnovers that's what fueled most of their runs. And then the Bucks, especially in the first half, got out in transition against the Pacers. And when both teams were in the half court, it was a struggle. But the Bucks offense, I mean, you see this against nearly all of their opponents. So many of their possession devolve into a lot of times either Giannis or Middleton or Bledsoe trying to drive either from the wing or the top of the key, the nearest defender one pass away, gapping off whoever is being their guarding, trying to drive, activate that defender, but not really drawing two guys, but also not really having anywhere to go, passing it to the next guy with no advantage gained, and then the other guy tries to do the same thing. And the Bucks have some guys who can be effective, but the spacing just really is not there for them. When you're playing with Giannis and another center on the floor, it can be tough. Middleton does not really space out to three. He's also shooting only 34% from three this year, and we've long quibbled with him not getting enough attempts up from downtown. And so there isn't the spacing on this team, and there isn't quite the imagination or the flow to take advantage of that in the half court. And what that leads to a lot of times is, especially at the end of games, we've seen this down the end of a lot of their recent ones, Giannis just having to try to create a mid-range jumper, and he really has not been effective with those. This one, he missed a free throw that could have tied it, and then after he drove to the rim, or dove to the rim, I should say, with just under a minute left, and then he missed a tough baseline fadeaway out of the post, and like, he'll try and post up. There's not enough space, again, for him to really work his guy into the post and get in the lane and really do a power move or a hook shot. He's got to end up just shooting over these guys, and he's got the size advantage. If he could ever make that shot, it could be a powerful weapon, but it's just not there yet. And those are just not good enough shots in the clutch for this Buck team.
And somebody who can help their offensive flow and spacing to a point, he looks a little bit more comfortable with his jump shot at moments, is Jabari Parker. But Jabari brings his own downsides because defensively, he is still just awful. And broadly speaking, well, I mean, there are times that he can
still put together. I mean, it's really regressed. I mean, he took some small strides last year, but it's really regressed.
Right? Yeah.
He's one-on-one. He's just a complete turnstile right now.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was talking about his jump shot has gotten better, not his defense.
Oh, okay. My bad. Yeah.
No. His defense hasn't gotten better, and he can get beat by guys who should not beat him. And Jabari isn't, you know, an elite athlete in that sense, but when you see, like, Sabonis get by him or some of these other guys, you're just sitting there going, like, how is this happening so frequently with him? And I'm not willing to write it all the way off yet, but it's getting closer, and that creates seams in a defense. They can still defend well with him on the floor just because they have a lot of other capable guys.
Yeah.
But especially if we're talking about what they could be in the playoffs, because we're treating Milwaukee as a playoff team this year because they're going to make it, that will be an issue. Like, who's going to be their fifth guy? Is it going to be a center? Is it going to be Jabari Parker? Heaven forbid, is it going to be both? And he can answer that question for them by be working a little harder, by being a little bit better defensively, but he hasn't been.
Yeah, the help defense also is not great. He has this amazing ability that whenever he goes for a strip or goes for a block shot, he somehow manages to end the play, you know, 5 feet away from the guy that he was guarding when he began that attempt. And really just when his defensive fundamentals, you know, Mike Schmitz would say that he really opens up his hips a lot, is able to get blown by. And then despite being, you know, 250 pounds, guys just kind of go right through him. And, you know, he doesn't really have that aspect of playing strong and being a deterrent in that way either. So he might be an example of, you know, Ben Falk, who is arguing that we should end the foul out. I happen to disagree with him overall, but this is a point in his direction where guys like Jabari, it's just like they just learned to kind of look like they're playing defense and not foul so they could still stay in the game. For the Pacers, who we haven't talked about as much here, Boyan has been on fire. I think he's had 20 points in half of like his last 13 or 14 games. Had 5 three-pointers in this one. He is really locked in from downtown. We talked about their contract situation and whether they would guarantee him for next year or not. I think, you know, a lot of how well they play going down the end and in the playoffs could determine part of that also. And then he was just absolute ice in his veins on those free throws at the end as well. And he's avoided getting killed defensively this year. The Pacers have not been a great defense, but, you know, he's been asked a lot of times to even guard some of the best players on the other team. And he's done a reasonable job of that. And then Thaddeus Young, I thought, played a pretty good game against Giannis. He's one of the better matchup that you can have against him from a size standpoint as a combo forward.
Something else I wanted to bring up, and I'll probably compile full stats for this for the 15 and 60 on Sunday, but when I watch the Pacers during this span, what I've been noticing is just how much they miss Darren Collison, and that's on both fronts. So offensively, he's a more capable and comfortable shooter, and he can do that, but also not having Corey Joseph on the second unit. You know, now they're playing Joe Young more. They don't have the depth in case one or both of those, like in case one of those guys gets in foul trouble or they're not, you know, they turn an ankle or something like that. And yes, they were able to win this game, and they defended, and they not only did they force 16 turnovers, 13 of those 16 turnovers were live ball, and that really goosed Indiana's offense. But so you think about, if they didn't have that, like they're half court, they just didn't have the juice in a lot of this game. They were able to win, and that's great that they were able to win without him, and they, as I said, they've won the last three in a row, but they need him to be competitive against teams once we get into this. But he should be back by then, so I'm not super concerned.
Yeah, you mentioned those live ball turnovers. The Pacers added 6.2 points per cleaning the glass above average, which was 95th percentile in this one off of those steals. They really were running it down the Bucks' throats, and there were some absolutely brutal turnovers. Eric Bledsoe was the big scorer here for the Bucks, led them in shot attempts 10 out of 22. Middleton really struggled, 6 points on 1 out of 7. Bledsoe does miss some passes. I mean, there was one side pick and roll early in the third quarter where he gets in. he comes off, gets into the lane, and Tony Snell was on the opposite wing. His man was all the way into the nail, middle of the free throw line. Just Snell was wide open, and Bledsoe just never saw him, and then ended up taking a brutal contested three at the end of the possession. So Bledsoe, I mean, remember going back years that he played shooting guard at Kentucky on that team with John Wall, and the discussion was he's not a natural point guard, and he's had to work at that, but he definitely missed some passes in this one. I really appreciated the objectivity of the Pacers broadcast in this game, especially in contrast to some of the others we've seen. That OKC Portland game was absolutely brutal in terms of OKC. I usually try to avoid them. There are plenty of broadcasts that just cannot be objective about things like refereeing. And when, you know, certainly when he feels like a missed call goes against the Pacers, they'll say it. But, you know, when Victor Oladipo double dribbled, he's like, yeah, that's a double dribble. He just says it. Lance Stevenson had this ridiculous play that's going to at least get him a fine. You'd have to imagine he just tripped John Henson when he was running down the court. Henson wasn't even close to being involved in any kind of a play at all. He was well behind the ball, and he just tripped him as he ran by. Henson supposedly had given him a shove earlier, but that's obviously, you know, just tripping a guy is beyond that. So Stevenson may be hearing from the league office, but the Pacers broadcast actually saw it and showed it coming out of a commercial, which I don't think a lot of broadcasts would necessarily do. So I appreciate that. They're not one that gets talked about a lot, but I actually, usually when they're on, unless it's just some of the absolute top crews, I like to do Pacers broadcast. All right, we'll move on here. But first, this from the toothbrush that I use, Quip. Two things to say about Quip. Number one, if you're not using an electric toothbrush at all, you need to. Number two, if you're using another electric toothbrush, Quip is both more economical, easier to use, smaller, and in my opinion, it does a better job than other electric toothbrushes. If you're not using an electric toothbrush, maybe you're one of these people who just works incredibly hard and brushes for 2 full minutes and has a perfect brush all the time. Make sure you get every single portion of your mouth. But why put yourself through that? And if you're not willing to do that with a conventional brush, you're going to get what my sister calls sweater teeth, which is when it feels like your teeth are wearing a sweater of plaque. You can actually feel the plaque on your teeth. No longer when you use a Quip toothbrush. It's a slimmer design. It's a fraction of the cost of traditional electric brushes. You don't ever have to charge it because it just uses a AAA battery that lasts for about 3 months. And then you can join their subscription plan. They'll send you another brush head and another battery. So it's all just plug and play. Extremely easy to use. It was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. For that reason, their subscription plan is only $5 every 3 months. And it has a timer that makes sure that you brush for the full 2 minutes. Every 30 seconds, you get a pulse to remind you to go to a different quadrant of your mouth. It really just revolutionizes brushing your teeth. The way to get started with them, getquip.com/capspace. That'll get you your first refill pack free. And Quip starts at just $25. So it really is just so much less expensive than conventional electric toothbrushes. There's no reason for them to be that expensive. You can take it with you on the go as well. Those conventional electric toothbrushes really are kind of too big to do that. And you have to bring the charger with you if you're going to be gone for any amount of time. Don't do that with Quip. Once again, getquip.com/capspace. Easy to remember that URL. We talk about capspace all the time in the program. Getquip.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us. Let's get to Lakers Portland now. This was awesome. We picked a prescient time to say, or at least I did, I don't know if you agreed with me, that Damian Lillard was playing at an MVP level over his past 20 games because he basically single-handedly won this game for the Blazers in the fourth quarter, what eventually became a 108-103 Portland victory.
I was very impressed with the Lakers throughout this game. I think that the way that they came back after they got in an early deficit, I think Portland went up like 8 and they came back and they had this lead and it never felt totally safe. And the reason it never felt totally safe was because of Damian Lillard. And then he scored 14 consecutive points for the Blazers, not overall. I think it was close to a, it was a big run, but it wasn't a 14-0 run. And 19 in the fourth quarter in just 8.5 minutes. And some of that was exploiting defensive mistakes, but a lot of it was just Damian Lillard. I mean, that 1-3 he took from, God, what was that? Like 29 feet? That one that was just, he's incredible.
Yeah, so they trailed 97-86 with 5:26 remaining. Dame assisted CJ on a 3, got fouled, and then proceeded to make 4 straight 3-point shots, a 28-footer, a 28-foot step back, another 28-footer coming off a dribble handoff out of the corner. I mean, the footwork on that was absolutely preposterous. And then he made another 3 off of Shabazz Napier assist, then continued to get into the lane and get fouled or set guys up at the end. He missed a few free throws that made it closer than it should have been at the end. But it was really just, I mean, that takeover, those 4 straight threes and the CJ3 as well. I mean, that was just, and it was all him. I mean, and it's been all him for this Blazers team, which, you know, we talked about the stats yesterday coming into tonight, 111 offensive rating with him on the court over the last 20 games. And when you consider the dearth of offensive talent that they have on this team, it's truly, truly incredible to reach those kind of numbers.
For the season, he has a 65.2% true shooting in clutch situations. 33 usage isn't crazy high, but I'm going to pull up the numbers while we're talking about this for the last 15 to 20 games, because it's been incredible. And there are some parallels to what Russell Westbrook did last year. I mean, we argued that in the clutch, and I would say it's more sustainable for Lillard than it was for Russell Westbrook. But the idea for MVP was basically it's value added, whether or not it's repeatable. It's value added, and he has been spectacular. And I mean, in this game, it turned a loss to a win, and it could really matter for them. I mean, these teams are all super bunched up. The Lakers played very well overall in this game, despite not having Brandon Ingram. A lot of things I want to talk about with it, but Lillard swung that margin from being, you know, it was 11-point game with 5.5 minutes to go to a win with, I think, one other shot made by somebody else on his team.
And the Lakers had done a pretty good job on him, and CJ Lonzo, I thought, played pretty well defensively. At the end, I think, you know, Lillard just got too hot to handle. We saw that Lonzo on those last two isolations where Lillard blew to the basket and the Blazers ended up missing layups, but getting the offensive rebound in the last minute, and the Lakers ended up being forced to foul until Lillard missed two free throws and they still actually had a chance to tie. But Lonzo was trying to force him to his right. I think you got to do that with Lillard, because going to his left, he'll push off with that right leg. Usually your right leg is stronger, and he is just so explosive attacking to his left. And then he's more comfortable shooting the step back going to his left as well, if by some miracle you cut him off. Now going to his right, he's very effective too. He's got one of the better step backs going to his strong hand, which is actually a harder side to step back to in the NBA, but it's not the same as when he goes left. And so the first time Lonzo tried to force him to his right into the help, that didn't work. He was just too fast. He blew past him. And it's really hard to direct a guy without just like giving up a straight lane to the basket when he can shoot from so deep and you got to press up on him. I mean, even if he just, you know, takes a couple dribbles to his left, like you can go laterally, create the separation that way, and then blow to the basket. There's no way to fall back and kind of get back in front when you're starting off having to pressure that far away from the basket. And it was just really, really been enjoying Damian Lillard, one of my absolute favorite players to watch in the NBA. Let's talk a little bit about the Lakers, though. I thought probably the most encouraging thing about this game for him, you mentioned the absence of Brandon Ingram, they're playing some funky lineups, was the play of Julius Randle, especially in that third quarter when he almost fouled out the entire Blazers team.
The Lakers got into the bonus with, I believe it was 8:58 remaining in the third quarter.
Yeah.
And while the Lakers are not a spectacular
2012 flashback by that point, although these were all legitimate fouls to my mind. I mean, they were just,
absolutely.
And you know, the Blazers have a rather foul prone big man rotation with Myers Leonard and Zach Collins and Nurkic, all those guys. But I definitely still the number of free throws, I was like, man, this is reminiscent.
And while the Lakers are not the greatest free throw shooting team, they were 24-31 in this game, and that's, I believe, stronger than they are for the season. I would have to go back and check it, but they earned it. They earned it getting there. And Randle, at his best, at his most engaged, his combination of physical skills is really impressive, and it is hard to contain. I mean, the jump shot is limited and probably will be for a while, but he's so powerful that if you can't really stop him initially, he's going to get some rhythm. He's going to get there. And if you freak out when he does, then he's going to get fouled, or, you know, maybe he gets a good shot at the basket, something like that. And this was not a circumstance to me like in the Miami game when I got frustrated that it didn't seem like Hassan Whiteside knew the scouting report on him about the Randall's one-handedness. This seemed more like he was just beasting Portland's guys consistently.
Yeah, he is. And Zach Lowe had this stat a few days ago that he's shooting, I believe, under 20% outside the paint, but certainly on like jumpers outside of 15 feet, something like that. And so the jumper, if anything, has regressed. That was what everyone's been pointing to as having to advance. But the way the Lakers have it set up now, it's coming to fruition now, something we talked about in the offseason. season when Randall projected as the starting power forward. We didn't see that from him early, and then he going into the starting lap is Brook Lopez really has been more the guy to space the floor. And so Randall, he's too quick for a lot of true centers, even too strong for a lot of true centers. And yeah, you know, you can back off of him, that's fine. And what used to happen with him, he's improved his finishing and his strength even more now. What used to happen to him was you'd kind of back off him, he'd go into guys, and he wasn't really able to finish at the rim that well over contest. But now he's gotten so strong, he's able to avoid committing the offensive fouls that he just knocks guys backward. Like there was a play where I forget who it was, drove the baseline, found him under the rim, and Yusuf Nurkic came over to help. Nurkic weighs 280 and he's chesting up. I mean, most guys, if you got a body on you like that, like you just can't go up with any kind of strength. And Randall just shouldered him out of the way, and he didn't dunk it, but he just laid it in pretty easily. And that's the type of play he's been able to make. And so if he does that to Nurkic, you can imagine, you know, the power that he was using to go past guys like Leonard or Zach Collins, who really just try to get in front of him. But if you try to get in front of him and you can't, and he gets a shoulder by you, you're going to commit the foul, and he's going to just go right through you anyway.
Lonzo Ball had a rough night shooting at the beginning of the game. I think he started 1-for-4 or 1-for-5, but he did hit a couple of big threes late. Some echoes of that game against San Antonio, though he shot better, much better in the context of that actual game. And I thought for the first three quarters, he did a solid enough job defensively. This wasn't his best performance, but Damian Lillard's going to make guys look bad. But then in the fourth, for the most part, there was one play where he lost him late. I think he was just thinking about helping, and it was like 3 or 4 seconds left when Napier just threw the ball to Lillard. But for the most part, I thought Lonzo did a pretty good job.
Yeah, he did. And I thought it was interesting. You'll recall that down the end of that game against San Antonio, I mean, they had Travis Ware in the game, but they had Lonzo running the show. And Lonzo hit a couple of big step backs going to his left against a drop coverage, similar to what the Blazers play. And here they had Isaiah in. He was running the show. And this was a throwback to Cleveland type of game for Isaiah. 5 out of 21, 1 of 9 from three, did go 8 of 9 from the free throw line. I thought the Lakers shot under 30% from three, 11 out of 37, and missed a ton of wide open ones that really could have caused problems for the Blazers, broken the game open when, you know, the Lakers had a 10-point lead for about 12 minutes of this game from mid-third to mid-fourth, and just missed a lot of threes during that period. But it was a struggle for Isaiah, but they had the ball in Isaiah's hands. They went to Caldwell Pope a little bit. Wasn't really Lonzo running much pick and roll. He had a couple of chances there where they switched it. He threw a great pass to Brook Lopez. They had to help, and then Randall got a dunk late. But other than that, it wasn't really Lonzo. They also ran a screen for him coming off the ball to the corner, an old Golden State play called Fist Up, where a pick and roll and a floppy type of screen, shouldn't say floppy because that would mean there's screens on either side, but a down screen to the corner occurs simultaneously. That Golden State always runs it at the end of quarters. They ran that for Lonzo, and he got wide open, just couldn't hit the three. But his three ball does look better. The concern that I have, I tweeted this during the game, was, and he had three free throws at one point, and was just, two of them were just totally broke, like barely even hitting the rim, like because they were off to the side. If he doesn't become a better free throw shooter, there is no history really of guys shooting below 65% from the line who have become plus shooters, especially at the guard.
It is definitely a concern. And the three, it does look better, and that is huge. It's essential for him at this point to at least become consistent there. I mean, the better he gets, the more valuable it is. And I like him more still, even though he's had some better pull-up ones recently. I still like him a lot better as a catch-and-shoot guy than a pull-up guy. But he's going to have to, you know, he's going to have to reach that, because also we see this a lot with guys, and I think this has been part of what has helped Drummond, and they're in different places, Lonzo Ball and Drummond, who all came into the league incredibly young. But I feel like his struggles at the free throw line are affecting a little bit his aggressiveness. He's also not great at getting to the basket anyway. That wasn't something that was really, and UCLA, they had way better spacing than this Lakers team does, and he still wasn't spectacular there.
Two-pointers, just to break in quickly, the two-pointers that he took, one was a drive where he just kind of threw up a finish over Nurkic, and then he tried to get a tip in right after that after his own missed layup. Those are the only two-pointers I think he took in this game.
And for the season, he's only taken about 30% of his shots at the rim, and those shots have gone in less than 50% of the time. So, and when you a low free throw rate, you just need that as a base to your offense, not only for you, but for the rest of your team. They got into the bonus here. And actually, that ties in with something I wanted to talk about, which we didn't. We talked about how the Lakers got into the bonus early in that third quarter, but also Portland's offense looked abysmal there. Yeah. They just couldn't get good shots. They weren't even making the ones that they did get. And that 15 points in the quarter, sure, part of it was just being disjointed because of the foul trouble, but also it showed some real concerns about where they're going to get their offense from if there are stretches where Lillard and McCollum aren't hitting shots because, you know, Aminu struggled some from the field. Evan Turner wasn't dominant in this game. Yeah. Napier had a couple moments, but not very much.
Evan Turner, with Mo Harkless out, still only played 23 minutes, and they closed the game with Lillard, McCollum, and Shabazz Napier, who was almost out of the league before he came to Portland. I mean, that's just, it just shows you like how, what a disaster that Turner signing was, that even if his primary competition for playing time is out, he's still not playing. And they're going with two big lineups as well, you know, that really don't work that well, but they decided, hey, we'd rather play two bigs than play Evan Turner and Aminu together.
We could also make an argument, I mean, because Napier's had a nice year. Connaughton played 18 minutes in this game. You know, like just the fact that those guys are getting close to it, and yes, they have had better years than we've expected, but Evan Turner, high-profile signing, you know, the gambit of spending a lot of money that year and basically just hoping it worked out. Like, yeah, it was use it or lose it in that sense, but the downside, especially considering that was really the extent of the cap rise, was that they had to go through it. And this year, remember, they had the mid-level exception, didn't use it this year, partially because probably because of tax concerns, and they probably couldn't have gotten a good wing for that because wings were so in demand and will be for as far as I can look into the future. But when you make a bet and you lose, especially at that position, even if you're Paul Allen, it still hurts.
Couple more things here before we talk briefly about some things at the end of the game. KCP played 41 minutes. He was closing at the three, was plus 10, had the three ball working at three out of five. They off the bench now, and they're very limited with some of the injuries that they have with Ingram out in particular. And they've now bought out Corey Brewer, who, you know, wasn't really helping them. I think that's fine to move on from him. But Travis Ware plays 16 minutes. And if you're trying to actually win games, I mean, how is Luol Deng like not active? Like he's better than Travis Ware. I mean, Travis Ware basically single-handedly, you know, he's a guy who's played hard, but he's a 27-year-old stretch four who doesn't rebound and can't really move his feet well enough to switch. And he just got cooked by Lillard to kind of let the Blazers get their offensive footing again late in the third quarter. Like, Luol Deng can't do a better job than him. Like, why not just activate the guy and play him and see how he looks? I mean, every little bit that he can play, maybe he at least can, you know, make you a little bit of money if you end up waving him or buying him out or stretching him in the future, if nothing else, and, you know, do right by this guy that you've just been sitting on the bench the whole time. Maybe there's an agreement between them that he's not going to play or something, but you have to imagine even he would be better than some of what they're throwing out there.
Unless he got hurt, it's not like it could diminish his value at this point. I mean, you're sitting there. I had that, remember that idea at the beginning of the year of, oh, you know, maybe you could trade him for one of those disastrous contracts like Miles Plumlee, you know, Ben Deng makes more money than Plumlee does, and so you could get off some and then maybe stretch right. Miles Plumlee and that sort of circumstance. Right now, the Hawks don't do that deal. They don't even come close to it. And anything, unless you have an agreement that makes that more palatable to a team, is something that they should consider, especially now when everything is pulling the same direction. If you have young players like Josh Hart that you want to play, by all means, absolutely do that. But Josh Hart is out.
I mean, maybe even the Blazers, you know, for like a minor son. I mean, I don't think the Hawks are interested in anybody who's going to be any better, especially a veteran. But, you know, if he could rehab his value a little bit, maybe, you know, you trade him to the Blazers for a Myers Leonard and maybe one other small contract. So, you know, you're basically, it's kind of one of those contracts where, you know, you make him into a $5 million player by taking back the bad salary or something. But we'll see what ends up happening. We've got actually another good Lakers question on that little mailbag preview we're going to do tonight as well about their summer that we can get to. The last thing I want to say about the end of the game, KCP, under 2 minutes left, tries to draw a foul. His defender takes his hand back. He just throws it up. It goes in and out anyways. Momentum carries him towards the basket. Yusuf Nurkic gets the rebound, and then KCP, when they're in the bonus, commits the over-the-back breaker in frustration because he didn't get the call. I mean, that ended up just costing them two Nurkic free throws and was just a really, really bad play. And KCP does play hard. I think he's been really important to their defense this year. I mean, if you compare him to the guy who replaced D'Angelo Russell, certainly is a massive upgrade there. But KCP also does have these brain farts on occasion, some ugly shot selection on occasion. So you understand why the Lakers Spurs fans have some frustration as well, and this is an example. I will be back, gotta catch up on some news here, but first this from our friends at SeatGeek. There's nothing like seeing your favorite team or musician or comedy or anything that provides tickets going to an event in person. It needs to be done sometimes. TV is great, but the in-person experience is really the best. Danny and I have both used SeatGeek recently. I got tickets to a game in Milwaukee with my fiance, got a great deal on some fourth row tickets. It was like $100 each, pretty good. Danny was able to get tickets to the Barry Bonds, is it the jersey retirement ceremony?
Yeah, the baseball number retirement. I don't know exactly what the terminology is, but yeah, I mean, it was a rapid fire decision because they announced it and it had been, you know, the tickets had been for sale, and my ticket buying brain, because that's what I used to do, said, oh my God, I should try to buy tickets before they get really expensive, either as an investment or to go, and I'm planning on going. And so by doing that, I had to move within basically 5 minutes to go through all the purchasing stuff. And so ran to SeatGeek, had to trust the algorithm, though it's a stadium that I know well, and I'm thrilled with what I ended up with. And a lot of my friends had the same idea, but because it was just a little bit slower, they weren't able to get deals before everything spiked.
Yeah, SeatGeek searches multiple ticket sites for you, and then they have that deal score technology that grades every ticket based on value. So you know you can just pick whatever they rank as the best value in whatever section you want to sit in, and trust that they're saving you time without you having to go through every single ticket that's in there. If you haven't used SeatGeek before, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase using our familiar CapSpace code. Easy to remember, we talk about CapSpace all the time on the program. That's promo code CapSpace for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All right, news time here. Let's start with the Cavs. Tristan Thompson, these are the ones that just kill me, and why I believe that you need some sort of medical personnel watching the TV feed. Tristan Thompson steps on a Nugget player's foot last night, sprains his ankle, kept playing, and then the ankle swells up significantly overnight. And oh, by the way, now he's out for 2 weeks per Tyronn Lue on Monday night. And the medical staff, you have to just see, hey, you know what? This thing got rolled really badly, and we got to take him out of the game because, yeah, okay, maybe you might be able to play, but continuing to play on it is just going to cause it to swell up more. I mean, that's not always the case. There are certain guys like a Dirk Nowitzki or a LeBron where I don't think it's really the case. You know, those guys know their bites. They sprain their ankles so many times. They've come back from it so many times. But especially if it's a guy who doesn't sprain his ankle a lot and isn't really familiar with it, I think you have to just step in and say, hey, you know what? Like, we're going to take you out precautionarily so that you don't end up missing multiple games because you, and who knows, maybe it would have happened anyway, but I know it didn't help to continue to play on it. That's true.
What that led to on Monday night was Larry Nance starting in his place. Nance was impressive in a game that the Cavs won going away against the Pistons. 22 points, 15 rebounds, 2 steals, 9 of 15 shooting. And it's very possible, at least in the near term, that this leads to Nance becoming the de facto starting center. It all will get garbled up when Kevin Love gets back because that's the way this works. But you could very well see Larry Nance starting after that, because if they want to go with the approach of kind of two bigs, they can do that. In this game, they actually started LeBron at the four, JR and Rodney Hood together. Hood had started in JR Smith's absence due to the soup extravaganza.
Yeah, we found out that that's what it was. He apparently threw soup at Damon Jones, the Cavs assistant coach. No idea what the dispute was over.
Who among us hasn't thrown soup at Damon Jones? And that's not even the only Cavs news, because Jeff Green has now missed 3 of their last 4 games with back soreness. And while the additions that they made at the deadline have deepened their rotation enough that I don't think he needs to be a part of their playoff rotation, having the depth, especially in the regular season, is certainly helpful. And if this is a recurring thing, that becomes a big problem for them.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that's part of why they brought Jetty Osmond to the bench, so he could come off the bench in Green's role. They also went with Ante Zizic, who probably had the best game of his young career today. We'll see. You know, Green is having a better season than expected. I have this slight feeling that they're not actually going to miss him that much. We'll just wait and see. And perhaps part of why he hasn't played as well is due to this back soreness, but it sounds like it's going to be a chronic issue here. Speaking of soreness, Kyrie Irving could miss up to a week. You know, I guess they're okay without him against the Bulls tonight when they surged to a 24-5 lead. But after that Houston game where he didn't play as well, he apparently had some swelling. He's not going to have an MRI, but worth noting that this is the left knee that he reportedly threatened to get surgery on and just missed the season with the Cavs if he weren't traded. So apparently he's had some issues there. And then for the Lakers, we mentioned that Brandon Ingram didn't play. He got an MRI and that revealed a left groin strain. So he's going to be reevaluated in a week. So he will miss the next 3 games at a minimum. minimum and reevaluated doesn't mean he's going to play. You know, usually there'll have to be some sort of a ramp up period again as well.
One thing I want to go back to with the Kyrie story is that their next two games are at Minnesota and hosting the Pacers, both of whom they could really use him. And this gets to the idea that while they are still close in terms of record right now, the Celtics are actually three games behind the Raptors in the loss column and tied in the win column, that if they lose one or two of those games, Toronto's going to get a more firm grasp on the number one seed. I don't think that's devastating for Boston unless the wrong team gets the seven, but that could have these cascading effects. If the Raptors get a little bit of a lead, maybe they can rest their guys a little bit more. And because nobody's particularly close to the Celtics, that could in a weird way be beneficial for them, because then they don't have to push it all for the number one seed. They can kind of ease into it and be physically right for the first round.
They're already projected to finish five games behind the Raptors, which is remarkable because the Raptors, they're tied in the win column. The Raptors only have a 1.5 game lead on the Celtics, but since the Celtics have already lost three more games than them, you understand where that comes from. The Raptors have been playing much better than the Celtics have. Real quickly, who are you most scared of if you're the Celtics as a potential number seven seed?
Milwaukee or Philly? I think those are probably the two, just because they have the highest ceilings.
It really could be anyone.
And really what you're most scared of is Cleveland getting the three, but there's not much they can do about that.
Sixers are actually projected to finish with a better record than the Cavs, but I don't know, it's with Nance at center, I mean, Thompson just has not been playing that well. I think their starting lineup just was not that good. And with Green out, who just, you know, he's been better this year, but generally has been somewhat of a negative player in his career. I think the Cavs might actually go on a little bit of a run here. We'll see. I haven't looked at their schedule to see whether that prediction is actually a good one or not. But this is another interesting one. Brian Windhorst had a story that the NBA is going to try now to engage with high schoolers much earlier and really take on more of a grassroots approach. They want to get involved with elite high school players. Not sure what the form of this is going to take, but the Players Association has camps. USA Basketball has camps. I'm not sure whether this is going to be an academy. Actually, he said it's probably not going to be an academy situation, but Silver's aim is to establish a more comprehensive plan than simply just allowing 18-year-olds to play in the NBA again. This is supposed to be more mentorship from the NBA to provide skills to help them on and off the court, and open an alternate path to the NBA besides playing in college, and allow 18-year-olds to earn a meaningful salary if, you know, that's what they feel they and their families need. But this will have to be then the subject of collective bargaining, but it seems like the Players Association is willing to consider it, since they have taken the position that, you know, it's better to let players into the league a little.
I am a firm supporter of 18-year-olds getting in, but if they're, for whatever reason, they're going to be reluctant on that part of it, no matter what, I think having more support for young players, either that are at an NBA level or that could be, is vastly important. There are a lot of life skills. Kevin Durant actually talked about this a little bit today at I saw a clip of it at shoot around or practice or whatever it was, about the idea of what players learn being professionals. And you could do that argument through the G League or anything else, but just the idea of having your life be basketball. And I think that's one of the elements that can be in this basically wherever they go. And also in when we talked about the NBL a couple days ago, that can be a benefit there. And yes, certainly as somebody who went to college, like there are benefits there. But for these people who the best of the best who know that this is their next step, there is a benefit to learning what it's like to be a professional, because that is one of the biggest adjustments. And I hear this from players. I used to ask rookies this all the time late in their first year, is the idea of the grind of the NBA season and the idea that this is what you do, this is your life, is very, very different.
And a lot of teams now have staff who try to assist some younger players with that kind of stuff, but no specifics really in this from Windhorst. It's good that the NBA is moving this direction, trying to address these issues. Although the NCAA, Mark Emmert actually said he's open to the idea of the Olympic model, which we have been, or at least I have, I forget whether you're on board with it or not, but been touting for a while, the idea that schools don't pay you, but you can get an agent, you can get endorsements just like you can in the Olympics. So maybe that still would end up being more lucrative than it would be to just turn pro normally, because you really have college kids. There's just so much money in college basketball. You have to imagine some of that would start trickling down, even if it's just, you know, boosters from the school, or whether it's, hey, let's wink, wink, Jim Bob's car dealership, or the shoe company that sponsors the school and wants to get more visibility and bang for their buck, whatever. It'd be very interesting if, like, some players are getting it so good in college, they're just like, hey, you know what? I don't think I want to go to the pros yet. That would really suck if that starts to happen. But just so many moving parts here. Let's see what the NBA's proposal is.
I want to throw out one stat. This isn't really a news piece, but I thought it was interesting from ESPN Stats and Info. The Grizzlies today today. They lost to the Spurs in a surprisingly close game, 110-98 in San Antonio. They became the first team since 2010 to play an NBA game with none of the players who actually were on the court having been drafted in the first round. They have some of the highest profile successes of second round picks in the last decade plus, Marc Gasol and Chandler Parsons among them, but that's still pretty striking.
They noted that the last team for whom that was the case was the Utah Jazz in February of 2010. That was actually a good Jazz team. Deron Williams must have been out that day, but they had a rookie Wes Matthews on that team. Carlos Boozer, who was a second round pick, Mehmet Okur, I think was a second rounder as well. And I forget who else they had. Kyle Korver probably was on that team as well. Maybe he started, so he was not a first round pick. That's actually a pretty good team with like all second round pick. And the Grizz actually almost won at San Antonio, lost by two. LaMarcus Aldridge's return didn't look very good. It was only 2 out of 8. Let's run through a few of these quick hitters here. Kevin Durant, no surprise here, told Anthony Slater 100% he will re-sign with the Golden State Warriors in the offseason. If I were him, I wouldn't say that. I guess he wants to shut down any of the questions, not that they're legion by any means, but why just take away the potential to leave and like have at least a little bit of leverage over the organization, even if it's only to make them spend more money to bring guys in around you? Or if, you know, what if things just totally implode? Or what if, you know, Draymond Green decides to punch him in the face one day or something? Very unlikely that happens, but it seems to just commit like that in the future. He says he feels like he's already on a long-term deal here, but you know, you never know. It doesn't really do much good to say that, I don't think. I mean, you can say, as of right now, that is my plan or something like that. You know, anything on that, Mr. Warriors?
Not really. I agree with you in terms of the leverage play, but at the same point, he has that leverage because he's Kevin Durant, and we'll see where it goes. What duration of contract and what the value is for him is going to be a huge bellwether for the Warriors' long-term finances. It's not as variable in that as Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, who are both going to be up for new contracts in 2019 and 2020 respectively, but it will be important there. The next piece of news that I think is the most important, and we alluded to this earlier, but having a clearer idea of the timetable, Nate McMillan said that Darren Collison will not be back this week. It has been 4 weeks since the original 2 to 3 week timetable, and they have been winning games, this big three game push, most notable among it, but they are going to need him moving forward. And just the idea that he's out for another week and we don't really have a timetable beyond that is concerning, considering how long he's already been out.
I really just don't understand why you would ever say a guy is a 2 to 3 week timetable with a surgery like this. I mean, it's like, oh, well, the fans are going to like not buy tickets to these games because Darren Collison is out. I mean, I can maybe see doing it if it's like some big star and like you want tickets to be sold for 3 weeks from now, but I really don't get it. I mean, why not just give him a longer time period and then, oh, hey, he came back sooner. This is great. I mean, like, why not just set expectations low and then if he beats him, everyone's happy instead of like, oh, something must be going wrong. But yeah, I mean, I'm surprised when anyone has knee surgery and comes back in less 6 weeks, regardless of how ostensibly minor it is. Like, you're getting your body cut open. That does something to you. Even if they just did nothing but stick the arthroscope into him and then just take it right back out, you know, even that probably is going to be something that would cause some issues for you. In other news, Reggie Jackson, still not close. He apparently played one-on-one with one of their video guys the other day, but he's not close to contact practice. It was a light one-on-one. So you got to imagine it's a week or two probably 2 weeks at least, the minimum for him. Sam McGundy said he's not close. And with the Pistons having lost 9 of 11, really in free fall at the moment, you have to imagine they will not be rushing him back. They could change into tank mode pretty quickly here. What else we got?
A couple quick notes from the Hawks. Malcolm Delaney had to leave the game against the Suns, which they won, with a sprained ankle. He left in a walking boot. So Isaiah Taylor is presumably going to get those minutes. Bembry is out with an abdominal strain. So they're just they're losing some of their guys, and it would have been nice to see some of Bembry. Delaney's a different situation because Taylor's young as well. But they, you know, I guess you could say that it helps the tank, but I don't necessarily think it does at this point, considering it's not really better than their other options.
It's going to look even more ridiculous if they just decide to rest a Dennis Schroeder when he has 21 points in the third quarter of a game that they're in theory trying to win, when they don't even have any backup point guards at all, as they did at the end of that game on Sunday. I have liked what I've seen from Tyler Dorsey, though. He's got to keep an eye on it a little bit. With the Bulls, Paul Zipser has missed 5 straight with a left foot injury, and not something we would normally really discuss, but he could be important to their tank effort since David Nwaba has actually like looked like a pretty good player, certainly defensively. And then Robin Lopez still remains a healthy scratch. The Bulls are doing this thing where they're like changing up the starting lineup every 5 games for developmental purposes, but you know, this is a complete flouting of the league's new resting rules by the Bulls. The hope is just nobody gives a shit. And maybe the league has just thought, you know what, the new lot of rules are coming in next year. They think it might fix it. So it's just not worth like calling a big attention to force the Bulls to play Robin Lopez and win themselves some game. But it's still pretty critical. And again, you know, it's disgraceful for the league. The Bulls' incentive is to lose games. I have no problem with them doing what they're doing. It's all of the incentives, and at least the league has tried to change them. I don't think it's really going to work, but we'll
see. And Lopez is under contract for next season, so he is not getting his value hurt in that way. And I'm guessing teams are going to say, hey, look how unreliable this guy was. He played X number of games the year before. A guy who doesn't have to worry about that for a much longer time, Gordon Hayward. Brad Stevens said that he will not play this season, so Haywatch is at least temporarily, but probably for the remainder of the season, on hold. It is not a surprise, considering the timeline here and the severity of the injury. We would probably have seen something by this point, and so since we really haven't, then it's not surprising. And integrating him with the stakes that Boston believes that they are playing for as the likely 2 seed in the Eastern Conference, I can understand that even if he got to that point at some point in the, you know, let's say like 2 weeks from now, like got to the point where you can start ramping him up, well, I mean, that puts some other things in jeopardy, because that's not 100%.
Yeah, if he's not practicing by now, if he's not taking contact by now, I think it's really, there's no way to get him back in time to play at a playoff type of level. With the Rockets, Ryan Anderson has missed now 4 straight games with hip soreness. They continue to roll right along with him. He's more a guy I think they really need in the regular season. He's having Joe Johnson kind of makes up for what he was giving them. And the big issue would have just been playing some of their other guys too many minutes. Brandon Wright, who they signed, also has missed 4 straight now with right knee soreness, but they have plenty of centers. Also, for the Grizz, they signed Xavier Raton-Mays, a former high school teammate of Andrew Wiggins, to a 10-day as a wing player. Marc Gasol and Chandler Parsons actually did return today, though, against the Spurs, and as they almost won, but Andrew Harrison and Mario Chalmers are out, and Tyreek Evans remains so. And then in New Orleans, Solomon Hill has practiced. He's not playing on their current 3-game trip, but Alvin Gentry, their coach, said that the progress he's shown has been encouraging. All right, you want to do a little preview of our mailbag here for the Patreon subscribers? We'll be right back with that in a second. All right, so welcome on to our Patreon mailbag here for those who are doing at least a couple of these questions as a free preview, give you an idea of one of the things you get for our Patreon. You also, in the off season, get access to our salary sheets, real time updating within an hour or two of basically every offseason transaction or trade deadline transaction that occurs. Anytime there's a big trade, we will post the salary sheets and projections as well. It's also a great way to support us with the Twitter NBA show, which we're going to be doing, you know, certainly multiple times a week during the playoffs. That is not actually sponsored right now, so that's a great way to help us out with that. Actually, when we're talking for 6 straight hours and are delirious, it's always nice to get the support there. What else do we do, Danny?
We started doing Danny Storytime, which is me doing audio versions of my pieces, and it's more of a director's cut, sometimes about why I wrote it, how the process of writing the piece. And for some people, they actually prefer it that way because then they can listen in a car or something like that. And then we've had companion things. Dylan's done some really nice stuff for us before in the past. And we're always open to new suggestions. I mean, that's one of the things we do, early release podcasts when the situation warrants and everything like that. So a lot of different benefits there. And one of the big ones is the mailbag, where the questions typically are asked exclusively by Patreon subscribers, and then typically they're answered exclusively for Patreon subscribers.
Yeah. You're gonna do an AMA from Space Mountain when you're at Disney, right?
Maybe not from Space Mountain, but I'll probably do something. I'll definitely do airport AMAs, assuming the timing works. I love doing those, and I'll figure out something fun to do with Disney World if I can think of something creative. But we'll start this with the question from Matt Herblicka. I feel like a fun wrinkle to 2018 free agency will be how many restricted free agents exercise their qualifying offers. Could this finally be the year the tactic becomes a bigger part of the offseason, and who are the leading candidates to do this? And a couple pieces of data that are good to have here, and this is from Eric Pincus. I haven't gone back and done my own qualifying offer calculations yet. I do want to do that at some point, just because I like doing that. But so the starter criteria number that I have from him is $4.7 million, so that you'd be taking that on a one-year contract if you qualified for the starter criteria. And then if you did not pass the starter criteria, meaning you were drafted in the top 14 and didn't, then the qualifying offer is $4.14 million or thereabouts. So that's a good proxy for where it is for certain guys. If you were drafted high and you met the starter criteria, you're higher, but that's a good proxy for where it is.
And in many ways now, the current current cap environment is a throwback to the way things were under the old CBA, the 2006 CBA, when, you know, there were 5, 6, 7 teams that had cap space, and there really have not been that many restricted free agents who get offer sheets. And this year, there will not be very many who do as well, especially if it's going to be more than the full mid-level exception, which starts at about $8.4 million this offseason. So you'd have to say that, yeah, you know, there's going to be a lot of qualifying offers, but generally, that wasn't something that was utilized. There may be a thought that, hey, 2019 is going to be a little bit less restrictive, and therefore, you know, I want to just become an unrestricted free agent. But the history of guys taking the qualifying offer and then getting big deals is not really a great one. We saw it with Ben Gordon, and that didn't work out very well for him. I mean, can you think of any other guys who took the qualifying offer and then got big deals?
Greg Monroe.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, he got a max deal. But he also, it's worth noting, you know, there it was in a situation where they also had Josh Smith and Andre Drummond at the same time, and he couldn't play with Andre Drummond, and Drummond was the future. So I think he really, really wanted out of there.
Yeah, he was a special situation.
David Falk is an extremely aggressive agent. By the way, you remember how Monroe could have gotten a 4-year max deal from the Bucks, and they were really aggressive. They're like, no, the cap's going up. We're going to just go for a 2+1. Yeah, he's probably going to wish that he had taken that 4-year max, because he could have been making almost $20 million next year, and he will not be approaching that next.
And while he would have helped the Bucks, you know, I think they did. There have been moments this year where they've missed him, though the trade was absolutely a good one from their perspective. They got really helped by that just because of the reality of their luxury tax bill, and we can go through that. But so in terms of, it is a real risk here, because it's not like these players are coming out to a bonanza. This is not going, 2019 is going to be better than 2018 for a lot of teams, but it is not going to be ridiculous. And depending on how some of these teams spend, some of the big teams could be out of it. I mean, the Lakers, most notable among them, we don't know exactly what direction they're going to go. So Marcus Smart, let's say, Marcus Smart is probably not going to get an offer that he's happy with this year. But A, he's going to be taking a lot less money, you know, on a 1-year deal with serious risk involved there. But he's not going to be coming out into a market where he's going to be getting, you know, his full value, just because, or what he perceives to be his full value, especially. And Nerlens Noel should be a good kind of test case for that. Sure. And remember, Marcus Smart will be playing next year, presumably, on the Celtics when Gordon Hayward is healthy. And he will presumably be marginalized more than he has been this year.
And we'll see whether the Celtics have another big draft pick coming in or not, depending on what happens with that Lakers pick. Looking pretty likely now that that's going to go to Philly and it'll roll over to 2019. But the Lakers could maybe get in the top 3 in the lottery in case, if it's 2 or 3, it would go to Boston. If it's number 1 overall, it would stay with Philly. But, and also the other thing to remember too, is if you take the qualifying offer, guys who take the qualifying offer almost never come back the next year. I can't think of a single time where a guy has taken the qualifying offer and then re-sign with Bird Rights afterwards. I mean, that was the noise that might happen with Noel, but then he's had this lost year. We'll see if he can salvage it here in this last month and a half or so. But nonetheless, so you're trying to rebuild your value on a team that knows that you're not going to be there long term, especially if you're on a team that falls out of things.
And remember that you can't really be traded, because if you get traded, you lose your Bird Rights.
Right. That's the problem too. And Bird Rights are much more important in this current cap environment. So I don't think it's going to happen that much. And I also think that we've talked about this a lot of times, that whether it's extension, whether it's restricted free agency, agents don't like to have what is deemed to be a below market contract on their resume. In many ways, it is more damaging for agents to get their guy a sizable contract, which he then outperforms, than it is to just not get their guy anything and then his market value declines and then they end up just kind of blowing it, because, you know, that's not out there. No one knows that for sure. Whereas, hey, I got you this contract, it's under market. That's what really pisses guys off more than anything. So the agent incentives are not aligned here. So maybe we could see more qualifying offers get taken. But I think ultimately, when teams might be able to squeeze guys for, you know, a couple million bucks below their market value. But generally, if it's a guy that they really want to have around, they'll acquiesce and give the guy a deal that's like semi close to the market at least. And it's only the guys who are just completely insane about it who are going to take the qualifying offer.
Nerlens Noel.
That's right. All right, here we go. This is a good one from Jay Ratkowski. It sounds like focusing on analysis was a deliberate choice for you guys, but I'm just curious if talent, barrier to entry, contacts, etc. were all equal, would you have gone a different route, like maybe be a newsbreaker like Stein or Woj, or a beat reporter, or write mostly long form, or something else in terms of your basketball media career?
I would have been and would be absolutely terrible at what Stein, Woj, Shams do, and I've known Shams for years.
Not only that, you'd just be
it is
miserable.
A really big grin, but I am not sociable in that way. I don't, as Nate knows, I don't interrupt other people's conversations. I enjoy being introduced to people, but I hate like the first 30 seconds of a lot of that kind of stuff. So I would be absolutely abysmal at that job. I have a massive appreciation of long form writing because I've dabbled with it before and just I'm not as good at it. That's why I was so happy that my book is more a series of short form things. I think that was a lot more logical. And when they came to me with the idea, why I grasped onto it so firmly was because it fit within my skill set, though I did enjoy that process quite a bit. And being a beat writer is a different kind of grind than what we do, but I much prefer the one that we have to that. And I also feel like there are fewer people who are doing what we do. And so I appreciate the speciality, but I love what we do. I sometimes talk to people and they're like, really? Like they ask about my time commitments and all that. They're like, you spend that much time with it. And it's like, yeah, but I love what I do. And having that sense of the entire league is something that I really value.
You're completely saying the way you work. Like you outstrip even me. Even I need every once in a while, like some time to decompress or something. Like you're just like, whenever we talk, you're like, oh yeah, you want to do a pod? All right, let's do it. Like I got time. Yeah, I'm writing a book. It's okay.
I already did our point guard rankings for Wednesday.
But for me, this show is exactly what I want to be doing. I mean, that's just like, I don't have a boss. We can do whatever you and I decide we want to do as a topic. We're lucky enough that people seem to actually agree with us when we decide that things are interesting, that they also think so. You know, it's not just, hey, this is a boring topic, don't do this. If there are any of our pods that you think are boring, please let us know. We cannot do them anymore. And to be a newsbreaker, so much of that is just managing sources and quid pro quo. And I better make sure I don't piss anyone off with what I write. I mean, that's like having to just like watch what I say constantly to make sure that like I'm getting the message out there that my sources want, that I kind of, you know, is that sort of part of the quid pro quo for getting the information. That's like, I could never do that. You know, I mean, it causes too much cognitive dissonance for me to not be able to say what I think. And that would be the same problem when, you know, if I had an editor who was assigning topics to me that I thought were really dumb. Like, I don't have to do that right now. Like being our own boss is great. And that's why we just love our listeners and supporters so much, to enable us to do what we do and not have bosses. I mean, that's just like the greatest thing.
And one great way to support us doing that is to listen to the rest of this through our Patreon. This was actually, technically speaking, our February episode that the rest of this will be on. So you can check that out, patreon.com/DuncanLarue. And then we will have a March one later on, questions asked by and answered for Patreon subscribers, along with all the other stuff we did that we talked about before.
All right. Thanks a lot, everyone. Talk to y'all next time.